good morning, everybody. Welcome into the Mining Stock Daily long form episode for this week as we get you into, well, at least it's going to be a long weekend for our friends up in Canada. We are going to interview from Beacon Securities, Mr. Paul Gurney, a good friend of mine that has lived and done a lot of finance and market analysis from the great city of London. It's taken a while to get Paul on the show, but we had a good conversation. Obviously, we're talking a lot of things copper, but on the back of this, we talk about the latest installment of the saga between BHP and Anglo American, and really what this M&A news has kind of fevered the speculation in the copper market, if at all. So, good long conversation with Paul. We cover a lot of ground here within the big producers, but also kind of dive into what exploration looks like for the base metal companies as well. Special thank you to Fireweed Metals, Victoria Gold, Vizsla Silver, and Arizona Sonoran Copper for their continued support of the podcast. And as always, if you wouldn't mind, hit that like, subscribe, and share button on the YouTube or on the podcast network you receive Mining Stock Daily from. All right, everybody, let's jump into my conversation with Paul Gurney. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you on Tuesday as we report from the New York City SME Mine Finance Conference. All right, everybody, welcome back into Mining Stock Daily. This is going to be this week's long form episode with a very special guest. I honestly, it's probably taken most part of a year to try to get Mr. Paul Gurney onto the podcast. In fact, I had to do everything I could in my powers that be to get Paul on. In fact, he had to change jobs to get this going on. Unfortunately, I couldn't get Roaring Kitty on, but he might be Roaring Kitty of the resource sector. Paul, welcome. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you, Trevor. It's an honor to be here. Yeah, I look forward to it. We've talked about this for some time. So
we have.
Always have a good discussion. So it's good. Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it had to happen off mic, off record with a pint on the streets of London, which is always welcome. Looking forward to that next one here, Paul. But let's talk about, you're with Beacon Securities now. So correct. Maybe talk about what you're doing with Beacon.
Yeah. So at Beacon, you know, we're a long-term Canadian broker. We've been around 20 plus years, and I focus mainly on the resources space here based out of London. So mining stocks, energy stocks, potentially some agriculture, et cetera. So same thing I've been doing for 17 plus years, just, you know, on a different team.
Yeah. Give us a sense of what the commodity investment conversation's like on the streets of London right now.
I think it's the same one that goes on over there in North America, i.e. commodity prices are high, but where's the investment right now? Where's the equity capital to build things? And the thing is, there is money around to build stuff. There is money around to invest in companies. We've seen that in the last 6 months. We've seen some pretty huge equity raises, whether it was the likes of First Quantum or what have you. So the money's still there. I guess it's just a lot more discerning. And there's a lot of just chatter of whether that true risk capital into the exploration space is ever really going to come back.
So do you think it's starting to come back? Is this maybe players that were on the sidelines for the last 2 years that are starting to see the light again? Or are they starting to put that risk capital into resources?
Yes, I think it is. Depends on the commodity, right? So you have like really strong gold prices, really strong silver prices. You've got copper that's really running here. So, once the producers get bid up, where do you go for exposure? Right. You know, either it's a development project that's going to take a couple of years to fund and develop, or it's the exploration. So, you know, we'll see. There's been an uptick in inbounds and demand and people looking at it. But the critical thing, Trevor, that people look for is just, can this be a resource that can be a mine, not just a bit of moose pasture with some interesting drill hits?
Maybe let's start the conversation off, deep dive into what's happening in the copper complex here, Paul. Right now we're sitting at $4.74 pound. That's a big move. This is being recorded Monday. I mean, that's a huge move just for one day. In fact, it's about over 1.5%. There is a lot of news on the producer side of the copper complex with Anglo American rejecting yet another upsized bid from BHP. They put another offer in that was 15% higher than the price before that, and still Anglo says no. Is this given maybe a little bit of life if we see this back and forth kind of M&A battle? Is this giving generous thoughts of where to move into the copper complex?
Yes. Okay. For 2 or 3 years now, almost every macro presentation you've looked at has talked about copper as the key metal for the energy transition. And we've talked about on our side the dearth of funding of projects of new capacity that's coming on stream and how there's going to be a squeeze in the copper price. You're seeing that materialize now. So that copper price you're talking about, we're on the cusp of a break to the upside, and record highs are within sight. The thing that this bid does from a BHP perspective is it highlights how valuable installed capacity is. So you look at like an Anglo's, which, you know, from discovery to building a mine can take 28, 29 years. They just put a mine into production 2023 that they got in 1991. Okay. What was the price of copper in 91 versus now? I mean, it was way less, obviously. So for a BHP or any of the other large majors out there that have the balance sheet to do something, the replacement cost of that asset is multiples above what the NPV of it is in an analyst spreadsheet, because you just can't build a project like that anymore. And I think the market, and in particular, not just like the mining funds, but, you know, the macro kind of generalist funds say, if copper is going to be well bid here for some time to come, because there's really strong demand and supply is constrained, how do we get exposure to that? Where do we go? And you can go into the producing segment. That's great. But at some point, the producers even start to look a bit expensive, and you need to start thinking, where can I find a copper project that one day will be a mine? And there's a lot of those conversations and chats going on right now, for sure.
Yeah. Well, if these big producers are very bullish copper here in the next couple of years, and you know that even with these development projects that maybe you have some sort of interest in, financial interest in, you know, at least, even if you get permitted, is at least 10 years down from production. I mean, isn't the only scenario for growth is for acquisition? I mean, is exploration even on the table here for the midterm?
Well, not for the big guys, just they know what the assets are, and there's a short list of copper projects, right? So we all know that Cobre Panama is offline indefinitely, and that's 1% of total copper supply. With this BHP bid for Anglo's, if they're successful, it'll be 10% of copper supply. So all of a sudden, you have a very concentrated market where the large producers can, you know, tweak capacity based on what they see coming down the pipe. There's not a lot of big assets out there. And then you go into the mid-cap producer space. Again, these are names that are well known to the market. So it's not the large cap guys that are going to do the exploration. They don't need to do that. They can sit and sit back and look, okay, who's going to develop the next big copper project and where is it going to be? Is it going to be in Ecuador, where a lot of people are staking ground and looking at stuff? Is it traditionally going to be in Chile, which people are really comfortable with? The places that still get a lot of pushback are Canada, because Canada has a really difficult permitting and government environment, but that changes with time, as we know. And then the U.S. is just that in between, because we've got the U.S. wants to develop more domestic supply. So you're at this, you know, that copper price, you push above five. And I'm glad you said it in pounds, because I'm a per pound guy, not someone said the psychological level of 10,000 copper just got passed. I'm like, what's that in pounds? I don't know what that is.
It's called imperial for a reason.
Yeah. So when it goes through $5, I'll be like, that's my psychological level. But it's, you know, if you think about it, because I've been in this game for a while now, right? If you think about the last bull market in copper, it was 2011, 2012. And the price of copper, if memory serves, got to $5, $5.50, And then we had a gold company bought a copper project, which was Barrick bought Equinox, and at the peak, right? It was a peak copper price. And so it's been a good solid 11, 12 years before we've had a really, really strong copper market. Does the same thing happen again, where you have this race to snap up copper assets? In essence, it's already happening. So it has a lot of really interesting interplay, this bid for Anglos, if it does end up going to somebody, because then obviously what people talk about is who's next, what's next, and what's on the table, right? And big acquisitions are complicated. So whoever does get that thing, it'll take a long time to close it. But the last large-scale copper asset we saw was Glencore, I think it was Las Bambas or whatever, was or whatever they bought back in 2011. So we're at the beginning of a new cycle. So now's the time, I think, to look at copper and to start looking at things, because everything we've been talking about for what seems like ages now. And I find like the copper thing funny, because EVs, like 2 years ago, we were all convinced we're going to be driving an EV in 3 years. Now everyone I talk to says it's all hybrids. We're not going EVs. However, this AI thing means we're going to need so much more power. Therefore, we need uranium and copper. So it's like it's such an interesting thematic, because it works any way you cut it. And as humans, we're really awful at predicting where things are going to go. But direction of travel tends to be generally correct.
I don't even know if it's long enough to be called a saga, but it definitely is interesting from the BHP Anglo News. You know, coming from the gold space, Paul, whenever a major made a move, you know, with the, like, for instance, when the Barrick Randgold deal happened, we were wondering, okay, what's Newmont's response going to be? What's Newmont going to do? Because there seemed to be this competitive nature between the two largest gold producers, right? And so now that you have this BHP Anglo news out there, that playbook from the gold space kind of hits my head. And I was like, okay, what's Freeport going to do? What's a Rio Tinto going to do? Do you think those companies are kind of sitting back watching this and maybe picking up the urge to kind of continue to compete for more market share of the copper space now?
And I think, I mean, I've seen various articles saying that Rio and Glencore are both interested in both in tabling an offer or whatever. And it's not surprising, because again, if you don't get this asset, it's gone, right? It's gone for perpetuity. You don't get it back. So it's all a question of what they want exposure to. And I think everyone wants copper, like even gold companies, to your point. Barrick talks ad nauseum about wanting copper assets. And if you think about the cycle, like Mark Bristow, I think this would have been 4 or 5 years ago, he almost nailed it, okay? Because he talked lovingly about, and all the speculation was Freeport. And that was back when Freeport was like a $5 or $6 stock, right? I think that was 2018. So it's like, if he actually had been able to pull that off, it would have looked like an absolutely brilliant move. So timing here is everything. And the flip side of the coin is always, whenever you see large scale M&A, sometimes it means it's the top of the cycle. That's the part that some people think about. Well, if the majors are here looking for copper assets because the copper price has run, like why didn't they do this when copper was like 350? Like why did they wait? And inherently, the way I always position it is that we never pick the bottom, we never sell the top. It's always, teams need that confirmation bias that the price is starting to rally. And as the price rallies, then they're like, okay, I'm willing to miss that first 20, 30%. What I absolutely don't want to do is like buy something that keeps going down.
Any thoughts about Ivanhoe here and the Kamoa-Kakula project in Congo? I mean, stellar project, massive grade, right? I mean, just absolutely knocking it off the park. Every time I look at that chart, it's at a new all-time high.
I mean, you're setting me up nicely here, because I did the IPO. Well, I was part of the team that did the IPO for that back when I was back was at Canadian Bank. That was 2011, okay? 2011, IPO'd the stock. It struggled a bit because that was the peak copper, and then it was in the wilderness for, the mid 2010s, and then here it is. You look at it, and it's just what a fantastic project. And you look at the market cap of the thing, and it just keeps going. And everything that Robert Friedland said it was has turned out to be. And so you kind of just wait and see, well, look, where's he going next? He's got such an amazing track record. Like, where is he going in this part of Africa? And I think that they've indicated Angola is where they're looking around now. But they've got so much to work with there, right? And that's just like that there is pure copper exposure. But really large cap. And again, like you've got that whole middle of just copper guys that are, printing money at these prices.
Is there, this is a conversation, the question I'm about to ask is a question I've asked before here on the podcast, Paul, and it's just maybe a mere more speculative question, but there is kind of foundation behind the reasoning I like to ask it. I mean, beyond all of its success with Kamoa-Kakula and Ivanhoe, and I mean, just developing that project into the monster it is now, Robert Friedland had to do a number of big transactions to get that across the line and keep his name on it. And a lot of that had to come with the backing of Chinese capital. Now, given where we're at now, is there a possibility that backing of Chinese capital comes to hinder the project as far as any potential M&A by a Western company?
I think from the perspective of, I mean, I was at the Future Minerals Conference in Riyadh this year, and the main speaker there was Robert Friedland, right? So, and he's done a bunch of deals with the Saudis and co-investing and in his other vehicles. So if that were ever an inhibitor, you'd have to think someone like him has someone he could do a back-to-back with, take one person out and sell it on to someone else. He is a master of, going around the globe and finding capital under every rock and in every corner of the world. And obviously there's a bit of a softening towards China. And to your point, the Canadian government right now isn't approving any transactions that have Chinese backers behind it. So, it would be tough to see if someone came in where there wasn't a requirement for them to have to divest that stake somehow.
Right.
But I don't honestly don't think, given his, let's call it the old school Rolodex, like if he wanted to sell it, he could pull it off if he actually wanted to. But it's not really his style if you look at it,
Well, I do think the Toronto Securities Exchange needs somebody like Robert Friedland. Right. They need Friedland's in their corner to be, to be traded.
And to build these projects. Okay. Like I talked about Ivanhoe, it's called Ivanplats. Actually, we IPO'd it. It needed a lot of capital that wasn't available. Okay. 2015, 2016 was the bottom of the commodity sector, like absolute bottom, like brokers closing house, funds shutting down. There was hardly any public capital of the scale you needed to build a project. So he went to the places where the people would back him, and he got that capital to build a project, and he's generated an enormous amount of free will and capital and returns for people off the back of that, right? So you're right. They need someone like him, because these projects, if we are going to have more copper capacity and we're not going to have a squeeze in copper here, we need it to build stuff out, then these copper projects need $1, 2, 3 billion of capex to build. And where do you get that? Where do you get that from? That's the question. And it's usually a multifaceted solution. There's some royalties in there. There's some PE in there. There's some sovereign wealth funds. It really is like a multifaceted approach.
What about U.S. production? I mean, I've been reading The War Below by Ernie Scheider from Reuters. He wrote a lot in the book about resolution and kind of the push and the pull of getting that project over the line for like the last 12 years between various administrations, and also obviously local support and indigenous pushback in the area. Does this start getting pretty political here in the United States, given that we're in an election year, and things could drastically change almost it would seem like an immediate change come, if Trump does get elected and gets put into office in January.
Yeah. I'm not going to handicap it either way, but I can tell you if it's a new president, or it's Trump, new but previous, like, of course there's going to be change, 100%, right? So I think in the U.S. you've had a lot of this really friendly funding for the mining sector with the IRA the last 3 or 4 years. You've had a lot of loans. You've had a lot of that. I think if you look at the U.S. as having a strategy just as an entity, as a country, that exceeds what any president's going to think. I do think the U.S. is like, we need more domestic development. And whether that's uranium, lithium, copper, some rare earths, like, I think that strategy stays. It's just a question, if you have a new president comes in, generally they like to rip up a lot of what the previous person did and come up with their own entities and their own way of doing things. Mm-hmm. And kind of that's the issue with mining. It's like, these are long life projects. You can't really be swinging around to the whims of governments when you need to plan, when it takes, 4 to 5 years to permit a mine in the U.S. and then some, right?
Right. It's actually kind of crazy you said that, because I'm hosting a panel at the Society of Mine and Engineering Finance in New York next week. And I had to write an abstract for this panel and send it to the people that I'm sharing the stage with. And I'm just going to read it because it sits right in here of what we're talking about. I said, as the United States and its allies continue to publicly promote a renaissance of new energy infrastructures, one which will most definitely require new supply of metals, public debate continues to be centered on a key question: who defines the term sustainable mining? Politics on campaign trails may appear to promote new metal supply from within the country, but policy decisions from one administration to the other continue to prove an opaque process of mine permitting. In this panel, we will discuss what is most important for industry to support a critical minerals policy in the United States and beyond. So maybe I'll pose that question to you, Paul. I'll give you the first shot. who defines the term sustainable mining?
I love the buzzwords for our industry, mm-hmm. So, it's whether an energy transition fund or critical minerals I think any mineral is really critical that we need. So, who defines sustainable? I don't know. I don't know what one entity actually does define sustainable. For the U.S., obviously it has military uses, and for that they need sustainable supply. For us, which are trying to decarbonize, we have our own version of sustainable metals. For me, it nets out to, you can't be overly dependent as a world superpower like the U.S. is on any one country for a commodity. Like, you don't have to build out the supply chain and everything yourself, but if you're getting 80% plus of your rare earths from China, I think it's 90% plus of processing capacity, that's really bad, right? And I think that people should be able to come to an agreement on, like, well, you can't, this economic globalization model that we all grew up with, Trevor, is great in an environment where we're all friends and comparative advantage wins. But when you're not all friends and you really need copper or you need oil or whatever, like, actually, oil is your analog here, because look at the 70s, right? The U.S. was so dependent on oil and then got in a situation where a part of the world basically had them over the barrel. And the U.S. is like, we can't let this happen again. And now the U.S. is like, it's energy independent, right? And it's not susceptible to the whims of other countries or people who may not be friends at times. So you ask me, what's a sustainable mineral? I just say, like, all of them, except like lead. Lead's not sustainable mineral, right? Lead, mercury, I'll just give you the bad ones, right? The bad minerals. Yeah, everything else is there. Gold is like, gold's actually an interesting one, okay? Because like gold mining, and if you've ever been to see a gold mine, like a gold pour and all that, Trevor?
Yeah.
Like, you do not really understand what gold is worth until you go to a gold mine and you see what it takes to create an ounce of gold. like the amount of earth that needs to be moved and what needs to be produced. But at the same token, you're like, is there a better way? Like, is this really a sustainable metal? And then someone might argue, well, you see all the money that the US is printing and everybody, like, actually, this metal is the only sustainable thing we have. So that's an interesting panel question. I think government are so short-termist, it doesn't serve anything with a long-term vision well. And I think that's why when we're up against governments in the world who have leaders that are in power for a decade plus, that on the commodity front, they're able to actually plan better than we are.
But there still remains that opaqueness of, you know, the process of getting a mine built, permitted and built, right? And if you go every 4 years and you change hands and all of a sudden a new administration is going to do things differently, I mean, you have to kind of fit that into your risk profile as a mine builder, yeah. Right? I like you the do. Rio Tintos are doing with Resolution. I mean, it is just astonishing how you can a politician can be up on the stage and say we want to move towards a more green future, and then provide, you know, billions and billions of dollars of loans and grants to specific projects. I mean, it's not available to everybody. I mean, they have yeah. It is a subjective decision here by who gets that capital.
It is.
And then push it along to a point to where, well, you know, we're just going to hold this up because we don't want to offend somebody. Yeah, and it's just insane.
There's a perfect like experimental petri dish we have here because we have two countries, Canada and Australia, both resource rich and both have different approaches to mining. And one is phenomenally successful and things get built, new industries get formed. Australia gets lithium, ships it off to China, iron ore, everything. And in Canada, you know, we couldn't even figure out a way to ship export oil to China because we couldn't all agree that maybe, just maybe, we should have a different customer instead of the US so we could have a bit of tension when it comes to negotiation. And it's the same on resources. So like Canada, you know, the government, what gets them elected? Oh, a new battery plant in Windsor, Ontario, creating jobs in Windsor, Ontario, right? A new battery plant in Quebec, a new car plant. These are like the headline splashing things that governments can do that every communities are like, that's great. It's tangible, right? I can build a fat car plant in 2 years, or like the Ford plant in Oakville. Let's retool it for EVs. Everyone, you know, slaps each other in the back and says, this is great. Then it's like, well, what about the guy with the lithium project that needs you to build him a road? Like, who's 500 kilometers from Thunder Bay, has a really high grade lithium spodumene deposit and really needs like a billion of government support. Where's his support or her support? You know, and you don't see it anywhere in Canada. It's not just the permitting. It's the, you know, Canada's a remote place, but you've got great resource. Where is the support? Where's the government fund that says, okay, government's going to have a $50 billion infrastructure fund to support critical minerals? And they wouldn't do that, or that whatever it is, right? To your point, they don't do that because that doesn't get them elected, right? That's not something that gets that they're like, okay, that's great, but whatever. And it's the same. The U.S. is a lot is I think is a bit more patchwork than Canada, but it just seems to be the same problem in Canada. But in the U.S., it's more like whatever, if we don't have copper, we'll just buy it from somewhere else, right? Yeah. Whereas in Canada, that is their net wealth, right? Like Canada's an amazing country, but the resource capital they have could be tapped into way better.
You know, one of the things that Ernie Scheider wrote about in that book, and I'm going to reach out to Ernie as soon as I get done reading the book to get him on the podcast. But he did, you know, he wrote something in there, Paul, that just completely resonated with me, because he was talking about obviously environmental impacts and implications for mine building and development. And obviously those we within the finance side think about that very closely, because that can be make it or break it as far as a return on your capital. And he did say, and he wasn't trying to be, I don't think he was trying to be, you know, kind of snooty about it, but he was bringing up a good point where he said, listen, during COVID for 2 years or longer, we were told to follow the science, believe in the science, trust the science. Now, if you use that phrase for environmental impacts and processing for mine development, and we have a number of engineers and scientists that put these massive technical reports available. Now, just because that science doesn't fit your narrative, that's when you turn your back on it, right? Do we need, I mean, should we be like using those same key phrases and say, you know, just follow the science. It's right there in this 1,000-page technical report about environmental impacts of this proposed project.
Here's the thing I don't get about it. I don't understand from a technological perspective, like AI or whatever you want to call it, why these things take as long as they do. Right? To your point, like I couldn't read an EIA or a technical doc, the 1,000 pages that they put together, but you know, surely there has to be a quicker way to do this stuff. That's still, you know, that's still rigorous. Right. And it seems like still seems like a pretty manual process. And the government permitting process seems like these timelines seem quite protracted. Mm-hmm. So to your point, you're saying just say the line, just trust the science and give us the permit. Is that the
idea? Yeah, why not? I mean, it could work. It could not work. It could completely backfire. But I mean, I think it's kind of interesting how, you know, as long as that you can use it for whatever it fits your narrative, it's like gold, right? Like gold, the purpose of gold can fit whatever narrative you need it to fit at any given point. Yeah. Right.
I think the one thing I find really fascinating, and you read books on this on agriculture and whatever, how city dwellers have become so disconnected about where our food comes from. Right. And like, it's something like, any city, like if you cut off the food supply within like 4 days, it'd be riots or whatever. It's not that number, but you know, it's not far off. And we've become so disconnected because it's just there every day, right? I go to 5 grocery stores within a 5-minute walk of my house. I can buy eggs, right? And I don't know where they come from. And I find like agriculture is a quick cycle. Okay. I've covered agriculture a long time. There's a crop every year, right? Like we can read about high cocoa prices and then more cocoa gets generated and prices come down. Like it's a really quick cycle. Mining's like is such a long cycle, but I think we're so disconnected about where the stuff that goes into our stuff comes from. So it's like somebody can sit there and be protesting the opening of a mine and they're sitting there on their iPhone, like protesting it and posting on Instagram. You're like, well, your phone doesn't get made out of the air, right? It comes from somewhere. And yes, we can be more responsible and we need to recycle more and all that. But, you know, copper comes from the ground. It's where it comes from. So if you're not going to permit the stuff, then you're going to have to be willing to just pay more for copper, things with copper in it in the future. Because when prices squeeze, like look at uranium, what's happened the last 5-6 years. Uranium was like $20 per pound. We had Fukushima. We had all the destocking. And it spiked above $100 per pound in the last year, but you've got a dearth of supply uranium. The issue doesn't get solved quickly because mines still take time to find and permit and build. And so this is a situation where if you get into a really tight situation on a commodity, then you have substitution effect. Okay. That's fine. That'll happen, but that's where inflation comes from, right? Like, if all of a sudden copper goes to, let's say in the next 6 months, it goes to $10 per pound. I mean, that would be a proper squeeze. It's not going there. But if it did, like everyone would be up in arms. Why hasn't our government given more permits to copper mines? It's your fault. It's not like, well, you know, the copper mine was like in your state and you didn't support it like 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. But now you're supporting it because it serves your narrative because the citizens are up in arms because they're paying way more for whatever they're buying. So I just think like the disconnect, it's like between rocks and like people think of mine, they're like mining bad. Like that's what it is. And there's a whole segment of the population that's just like, I will never support any sort of mine. And I'm like, okay, that's great. Then just get rid of all your possessions and buy a plot of land somewhere. build a lean-to and, you know, just live there. That's fine. You can do that too. That's well within your rights. But if you're going to live in a house that has a bunch of electronics on a grid with a car, the stuff comes from somewhere.
Yeah, it sure does.
Sorry, that's my digression on stuff.
No, that's all good. You know, we got to go off on rants every once in a while. Lord knows I do it from time to time. You know, but when it comes to like if you do not find the permitting process favorable as explorers or mind builders, you know, I'm wondering if, and a lot of companies are doing this, then go explore elsewhere. Look for better jurisdictions. You know, obviously, you know, gold exploration permitting and mine building in places like West Africa can happen pretty dang quickly, right?
Yeah.
But there's a couple jurisdictions here that I'm just, you know, interested in getting your thoughts on. I'm going to throw three out at you. We can go one on, we can go through each one single base. I want to ask you about Argentina exploration under Milei. I want to ask you about Colombia, because Freeport just did a big earn-in agreement with a project in Colombia, and a lot of people do not like Colombia. And I also want to ask you about underexplored but like land of porphyry giants, Kazakhstan. Okay. There seems to be a lot of exploration going on in Central Asia. So let's start with Milei's Argentina, and if we're seeing a favorable economic setup for mineral exploration and mine development there.
I, you know, first of all, I think it's a great place to be for a lot of these commodities that you and I've just talked about. I think the lithium rush of the last 5 to 10 years has really helped bring the profile of that country up. Okay. Even before this change in government, the government change obviously been positive on inflation, and from the mining side, that's the issue, is getting your head around costs. Right. So it's like, if you've got all this labor inflation, that's where inflation comes through in, right? Like 60, 65% of inflation is labor. If your labor costs are always going up, it's really hard to get your handle on a long life project. So if I'm going to build a mine for 30 years in Argentina, like, and I have to sink $2 or $3 billion of capital, how can I be confident I can get my money out? What's going to happen on the labor side? And the road to large projects in Argentina is littered with many a major mining company. So the strategy has been, okay, if you're already in Argentina, great, because you know you have a use of proceeds and maybe able to do a project. But it's also been a scenario of, if you're gonna go in, it's a small capital injection. You're not gonna go in too huge. And under this government, maybe that changes. Maybe people start looking at big projects again, outside of just, you know, gold and silver projects and lithium. Maybe there is that opportunity to look for something on the copper side that requires a bit more of an investment. I don't think you could make a conclusion after 4 or 5 months of a government, you know, because there's going to be some rocky times that he's going to have to deal with. I mean, he's running, you know, an austerity campaign. That's not great for a population. Like, is the price worth the pain? That's, you know, he's going to have to go through that in the next year or two. But I think, if anything, if you're a contrarian, which I am, like, it's a place to look now outside of lithium. And they want foreign direct investment. They want the U.S. dollars in there. So, yeah, I'll thumbs up to Argentina.
Yeah. Well, since you talked about, you know, big projects in Argentina, let's talk about potential big projects in Central Asia and Kazakhstan. Has this been of some interest to you at all, Paul, for a little bit?
You know, Kazakhstan keeps coming up recently. I think there's still an attitude in the market that let's wait and see what happens. And I don't think, from a Western perspective, there's a lot of confidence in doing stuff in country. And that doesn't mean there isn't something to do, but I don't see a lot of appetite from, you know, my discussions for going into that country.
Why do you think that? Why is there no
appetite? I think it's still the fact that, you know, from a Russia perspective, it's still pretty much regarded as like, you know, being in, I don't want to say cahoots with Russia, but, you know, being a friend of Russia, being influenced by Russia. And that, you know, that it has a long mining history, as you and I both know, and stuff that's been really successful. You got Kazatomprom in there. There's a lot of great projects in there. But for some right now, it's just a bit too sticky, and it's like the relationship with Russia is just a bit too close.
Yeah. I want to ask you also about Colombia. I mean, there's a lot of exploration potential there. There's a lot of good exploration that's happened. They do continue to advance mines. I mean, despite there being from the investment community concerns regarding open pit mining in the country. But just as we were speaking today on Monday, this morning, Freeport announced a very big earn-in agreement with Max Resources for their Caesar project, which is very interesting. And so I'm reading this news and I'm reporting it on the morning briefing, Paul. I'm just thinking, well, if Colombia is good enough for $80 million of Freeport cash, then it should be good for anybody, right?
Listen, I think Colombia is a really attractive place. Okay, this is one of those, like, you know, gets a bad rap. The people who were in there, who haven't had a great time, the mining companies, I won't mention any, but you talk to them, they pulled up stakes and left. It's a very, very prospective region. And, you know, this is what we just talked about with governments. What's the truth in all governments? They change. You know, so if you're willing to wait around long enough, and it's a democratic country, the governments eventually change, and the people who oppose stuff turn to people who are for stuff. And to your point, it seems from a, you know, from an energy perspective, like a gas perspective, you know, they're wide open to that. They see the hard dollars that come in from that. And then, you know, from a mining perspective, it's a lot of money to be turning away if you don't have another income source, right? It is a lot of money to turn down. And I think they're, you know, they're taking their time to decide things, but I mean, I like it. It's a place to take a look at. And if you get, you know, any sort of decisions that are really like Freeport, you know, coming in, that's a pretty smart decision by them. Like, they have to look at stuff that can be big and that's cheap, right? They're buying at the right price because they can afford to take the risk. Right. I don't know what they've committed. I didn't see the deal where there was capital or anything, but they can afford to think long term.
Yeah. Well, they have to think long term. But even in a place like Colombia, your capital is, especially for exploration, goes so far. Right. And when you're talking sub $200 a meter drilling, it allows you to keep a good staff, keep projects moving forward. And if you have great access to capital, that means you can drill a ton of meters in a short period of time.
Exactly. And I think, you know, if I had to do a comparison, just think Ecuador, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago, when Lundin came in and bought the Lundin Gold asset, and everyone was like, they're going into Ecuador. And then they've built this mine. It's done phenomenally well. You've got all these other players who've come into Ecuador now looking for copper, and the whole a region that people were, you know, if we had this conversation 8 or 9 years ago, people would have been like, Ecuador, like, no, not going in there. Don't like it. The government's not friendly towards miners, the tax regime. And now all that's changed. And so if you, I like, no, I conclude exactly what you're saying on Colombia, like, and an exploration, it's about how many meters can I drill for this price? Because at the end of the day, it's a best guess, and it's like, I need to find something, so I need as many chances as possible to try and find it.
I would like to start wrapping up the conversation, but I want to talk about the gold miners, Paul, like the big boys, the big producers. And I've said this like week after week for the last probably 2 months, and I'm pretty sure people who frequent this podcast are going to get tired of me asking about it, but I keep pounding the table because I'm really anticipating those Q2 production numbers and the financials when you have added $300 on the price of the product, on the gold price. I have not seen input costs rise dramatically. At least the product price has outpaced it. Yeah. You have any expectations for Q2 financials and production numbers? Do you think it's going to get those people on the streets of London and New York kind of rattled because they missed this?
They haven't really missed it, right? Because everyone talked on that gold price move that the producers lagged. The reality is when you have a sharp move in any commodity prices, the equities tend to not tend to not move with them because the market doesn't believe it. And so to your point on Q2, if the producers can show the leverage, then investors will say like, okay, aha, this is, I need to start looking at this. So I'm with you on that. And, you know, energy prices have come up a bit, but consumables have gone down. So, you know, I'm totally with you. It's a show me story right now with Q2, and let's see what it brings. But when you have a gold price move $300 an ounce, it has to show leverage. It has to. There has to be cash on the balance sheet. And I think that flurry of activity you saw 3 weeks ago in the gold space, the M&A, was that indication of the senior producer saying, okay, valuations aren't moving as much as they should at these imputed gold prices. You know, we've been working on some things. We should probably move now. You know, so I'm with you on that. Let's just see, because I've been through this before where gold prices moved and then financials come. You're like, what happened? What happened to $200 an ounce? where'd it go? Right.
Well, I think a lot of eyes are going to be on a Newmont, right? Because their costs are just, I hate to say it, it's a very, I mean, I don't hate to say it. I mean, it is, it's unreasonable. Their cost per ounce is for as many ounces I put together. I think it just shows you the large companies are just, they don't have the leverage that they once used to have. They have the liquidity that big investors are looking for, obviously.
Yeah.
But if you're really looking for real leverage to the gold price, I mean, you got to look down the line to mid-tier producers that don't have the bureaucratic ladder, such as the Newmonts and Barricks, right?
Yeah. Yeah, agreed. Well, that's, I think, the ideal gold company is 2 to 3 mines. You know, two to three mines with growth, because, you know, when I covered Barrick like a long time ago, it was a 7.5 million ounce producer, right? Like, how do you maintain that treadmill? You can. There's just not, you know, they started going big and they blew up because the projects were so massive, required so much capital and were so complex. They just didn't work, right? So like 0.5 million ounce per year gold mine is a big mine and it's tough to find. So if you can cobble together 2 to 3 assets and get yourself to 600,000 to 700,000 ounces, well, then, you know, another 150,000 ounces is a lot of growth. And so, you know, swapping in and out assets is, and obviously managing those assets is great. So that's the sweet spot, I think.
Yeah. Well, Kinross is kind of bucking that trend a little bit. I am gold, probably sitting in that 2 to 3 project, spot that you mentioned.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this seemed all right. What about the Equinox going all in on Greenstone? Is that risk too risky?
No, this is what I mean about like everyone saying like, okay, the gold price is moving. I'm just going to, you know, if you run a spot gold price on the NAV of that, like for them, it made sense, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, we have a minority partner. Like why not own the whole thing? And obviously they know that asset more intimately than you or I could ever know it. So in their heads, they must think, well, actually this isn't a 12-year mine. This could be a 40-year mine. And so since I can see all that upside, we're about to build the mine. It's almost finished. Why do I want to share that with somebody who's just the minority partner? And if the capital is available, then you go for it.
Yeah.
And in their situation, it was. So, yeah.
It certainly was available. That was a big move. I mean, there's a lot of risk in that deal, right?
Yeah, there is. And you know what? In the end, what'll bear it out is if the gold price moves higher, they'll look like geniuses. They will.
Yeah.
If the gold price in 3 years is $2,800 an ounce, you'll be like, what a great acquisition. If in 3 years they have 5 years more mine life, but gold price is $1,700, you'll be like, that was terrible. It really is. It's a directional wager. And for investors who like own gold miners for leverage to gold, you kind of understand it, right?
Right. What are we, you know, we mentioned the Q2 financials here, Paul. I mean, what are some news kind of headlines or, dare I say, catalysts you're kind of like paying real close attention to here as we wind down the spring and head into the summer? I mean, what do we need to be watching for the commodity side?
You know what? There's been a lot of sharp moves in commodities. So silver is very squeezy right now. It's on a good technical level. We talked about copper. I think what investors in a higher interest rate environment are really just looking for cash flow, and it's still cash is king, and they want producers who demonstrate that leverage to price. So are we going to see cash on the balance sheet or buybacks, dividend increases? That it's as simple as that. And the last commodity boom 10 or 11 years ago, what happened with higher prices is everyone announced new projects and new CapEx spend. So it's like, okay, we got gold that's 20% higher. Let's just do another pushback. And all of a sudden you start mining lower grades and you never get the leverage. So that's what someone like me is looking for. It's like, are they going to bank some of the cash, or is it like, okay, this is a good opportunity to like go after some lower grade material that may not have been in our model initially, but now works.
Well, on the exploration side, even with this run in the metals, we're not seeing a dearth of IPOs come to the market. I'm not getting deal
No.
after deal of new companies and cheap paper yet.
No, it's not. I mean, there's a lot of existing companies out there that I think that you can look at it to begin with. But no, I think the emphasis again is still on producing assets. And across any commodity, because that's how people want the leverage. Until you get to a point where producers get bid up to a level where they're on free cash flow yields that don't make sense anymore. So, if you're on a free cash flow yield of 1% and you're imputing the spot price of whatever commodity, then the market's fully pricing in that commodity. So then you need to look where the disconnects are. And that usually tends to be in the junior space, right? That's why you get the gap. That's like, okay, the juniors haven't moved nearly as much as the seniors or the producers. Where can I find value? Who has the best project here? Who can get funded? Yeah.
Yeah. Is this one of those times where you're starting to see that? I mean, at least I've seen starting to see that those very cheap financings come around to the point where it's hard for the companies to do it because they're so dilutive. But as investors, it almost seems too good to be true because you're getting cheap paper.
Yeah, I think you've seen that for, I think, 18, 24 months. Like every deal has a warrant on it, right? So, it's just for the explore codes, they have to keep moving the ball forward. That's what's critical. Whatever company you are, if you're a project company, you got to keep moving the permits forward. You got to move engineering. It's stasis is the worst thing, because when you get the next cycle, if you haven't moved the thing forward in 2 years, you're left behind. So, but a lot of these guys, a lot of the junior sector, like I know they'd love to do larger financings, but it's so dilutive, as you point out. It's so expensive. So it's the cart and horse, right? Like, can we have a higher stock price so we can raise some money? Oh, we can't have a higher stock price till we raise money. So, well, I don't know. Maybe one day we'll solve it. Yeah.
All right, Paul. So you're with Beacon Securities now.
I am.
In a previous position, you had written the Gurney game plan. Is that
Yeah.
something that's going to be resurrected?
Oh, I that's on the institutional side. Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Okay.
For sure. Yeah. So
Okay.
you'll get your copy.
I loved it. I mean, it was short and sweet to the point. Totally, it had you written all over it because you actually
Oh.
were writing it like you talk, and like how you speak. So it was a lot of fun. So
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, where can people find you, Paul, if they do have any inquiries?
LinkedIn's always easiest. Yeah.
Okay. And that's Gurney with EY for anybody who's interested. And you're probably going to get a number of LinkedIn invites here throughout the
Yeah.
weekend, Paul.
It's all right. I was always like talking to new people and getting new perspectives. So thank you.
Yeah. All right. Well, I look forward to that next pint, my friend, and thanks so much for doing
Yeah.
this.
Likewise.
The wait was well worth it, I will say
Oh, likewise. Likewise. All
that.
right. All right, Trevor. All
All right,
right.
everybody.
All
Thanks,
right. Take
Paul.
care.
Thanks for listening, everybody. That's a wrap here this week on MSD. We will be reporting from New York in the SME Mine Finance Conference next week, so stay tuned. A lot of great insights from policy and industry those few days. So I'm going to be having a lot of fun there. All right. Have a great weekend, everybody. Be well.
The information presented should not be considered investment advice. Mining Stock Daily and its affiliates are not responsible for any loss arising from any investment decision in connection with the material presented herein. Please do your own research or speak with a licensed financial representative before making any investment decisions.